out of the nation's 1,300 shopping malls are at high risk of losing an anchor store, which typically begins a mall's steep decline. Another retail analyst predicted that 400 malls will fail in the next few years and that 650 of the remaining 900 malls will struggle to stay open. In the accompanying PDF, you can see a map of scheduled Macy's, Sears, and Kmart closures as of 2017. I grew up going to my local mall in Yorktown Heights, New York. It represented the height of many things to me at the time. Commerce, culture, freedom, status. I would stake out a few clothing items and wait for them to go on sale. Buying a thing or two would give me joy. I would run into classmates at the mall for good or ill. That time is gone for good in much of the country. When a mall closes or gets written down, there are many bad things that happen to the local community. First, many people lose their jobs. Each shuttered mall reflects about 1,000 lost jobs. At an average income of $22,000, that's about $22 million in lost wages for a community. An additional 300 jobs are generally lost at local businesses that either supply the mall or sell to the workers. It gets worse. The local mall is one of the pillars of the regional budget. The sales tax goes straight to the county and the state, and so does the property tax. When the property gets written down, the community loses a big chunk of tax revenue. This means shrunken municipal budgets, cuts to school budgets, and job reductions in local government offices. On average, a single Macy's store generates about $36 million a year. At current sales, tax, and property tax rates, that store, if closed, would leave a budget hole of several million dollars for the state and county to deal with. If you've ever been to a dead or dying mall, you know that it's both depressing and eerie. It's a sign that a community can't support a commercial center and that it may be time to leave. It's not just you. Dying malls become havens for crime. One declining Memphis-area mall reported 890 crime incidents over several years. Cars are keyed randomly in mall parking lots, and there is not enough security to provide the level of safety a family wants while they're at the mall, said one local resident. In Akron, a dying mall was the site of a man's electrocution death when he was trying to steal copper wire, while a homeless man was sentenced to prison for living inside a vacant store. The mayor of Akron eventually instructed residents to stay clear of the area before the mall was targeted for demolition. Ghost malls are an example of what I call negative infrastructure. The physical structure of a mall has immense value if there is commerce and activity within. If there isn't, it can very quickly become a blight on a community. It reminds me of when I first visited Detroit and its surrounding suburbs at the bottom of their decline. You could see all the hallmarks of people leading lives in a once-thriving economy. Hair salons, daycare centers, coffee shops, and so on. But as the economy decayed, people left and businesses closed. The value of all those buildings, storefronts, and homes went from hugely positive to hugely negative. Unused infrastructure decays quickly and gives an environment a bleak, dystopian atmosphere like a zombie movie set. I'm glad to say that Detroit has gotten a lot better since 2011. There have been heroic efforts to repurpose malls in innovative ways. Churches, office parks, recreation centers, medical offices, experiential retail, even public art spaces. There's a giant mall outside San Antonio that the web hosting company Rackspace has turned into its corporate headquarters. It's amazing to visit. But for every successful adaptation, there are going to be 10 others that lie vacant in disuse and become crime-ridden shells that reduce property value for miles around. Why are so many malls and stores closing? Developers may have built too many of them, but the main cause is the rise of e-commerce, particularly Amazon. Amazon now controls 43% of total e-commerce in the United States. It has a market capitalization of $435 billion. Overall, e-commerce has been rising by $40 billion a year since 2015, which is now pushing traditional retail into extinction. Amazon just bought Whole Foods to expedite their move into grocery delivery. Most everyone I know buys a lot of stuff on Amazon. It is virtually impossible for any brick-and-mortar retailer to compete against Amazon on price. This is because Amazon doesn't have to invest in storefronts and can focus on building an efficient delivery system at the highest volumes. Here's their other advantage. Amazon doesn't even need to make money. In its 20 years as a public company, Amazon often has not turned a profit. A number of years ago, some financial types noticed and shorted the stock, saying, Amazon doesn't make money. In response, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos stopped investing in anything new for a year and ramped up profitability. The people betting against the stock were burned badly. Now no one bets against Amazon, and its stock price is over $900 per share, making Jeff one of the richest people in the world. Jeff is dedicating $1 billion of his personal wealth to his space exploration company, Blue Origin, each year. A friend of his joked to me that we'll get Jeff to care about what happens on this planet one of these days. Amazon is known for its competitive, some might even say ruthless, practices. In 2009, they were trying to push diapers.com to the negotiating table, so they discounted diapers to a point where no one was making money. It worked, and they bought diapers.com for $545 million a little while later. I don't think Jeff Bezos has it out for local malls per se, but there will nonetheless be hundreds of thousands of people who suffer from the demise of retail, driven by e-commerce giants like Amazon. The mall workers, the people who liked shopping at the mall, the county workers who needed the mall's property tax to pay for their jobs, the property owners near the mall, and so on. Hundreds of our communities are going to have giant holes blasted in them by progress that will disrupt thousands of lives and livelihoods in each. And the victims are likely to be among the weakest in the labor market. Retail workers are paid less than workers in most other industries and typically lack a college degree. Where are they going to go? It's not just the malls. Little shops and restaurants everywhere are closing. You're probably seeing empty storefronts around where you live and work right now. A New York Times op-ed by the economic historian Lewis Hyman detailed the plight of towns in upstate New York and other places that have seen their retail sectors decline and offered some recommendations for how workers could readjust to the new economic reality. Main Street exists, but only as a luxury consumer experience. If the answer to rural downward mobility is to turn everyone into software engineers, there is no hope. Today, for the first time, thanks to the internet, small-town America can pull back money from Wall Street and big cities more generally. Through global freelancing platforms like Upwork, for example, rural and small-town Americans can find jobs anywhere in the world, using abilities and talents they already have. A receptionist can welcome office visitors in San Francisco from her home in New York's Finger Lakes. Through an e-commerce website like Etsy, an Appalachian woodworker can create custom pieces and sell them anywhere in the world. This op-ed is a great summary of the general constructive thinking. It recognizes that the retail sector will shrink and happily debunks the ridiculous "let's turn everyone into coders" idea, which is realistic for only a tiny proportion of displaced workers. If you dig into the author's alternative suggestions for workers, though, they're equally unrealistic and could only be offered by someone who hadn't tried any of them. Upwork primarily finds work for developers, designers, and creatives on a global scale. Asking a retail worker from small-town America to log on and get work assumes they have a skill to offer. These global platforms have people offering their services from abroad who can price their time at as little as $4 an hour, even for a college graduate. Getting work on these platforms is highly competitive, doesn't pay very well, and carries no benefits. Offices in San Francisco have either iPads or human beings as receptionists. They don't have avatars staffed by human beings in small towns hundreds of miles away. Selling woodwork on Etsy is the kind of thing that would work for a handful of humans and is unlikely to feed your family. On average, sellers' income from Etsy contributes only 13% to their household income and is intended as a supplement to traditional work. 41% of Etsy sellers who focus on their business full-time get their health care through a spouse or partner, and 39% are on Medicare or Medicaid or another state-sponsored program. It's possible that some workers in towns with dying retail stores could find menial jobs on their computers as telemarketers, phone sex operators, English tutors to Chinese kids, or image classifiers to help train AI. That's not exactly an appealing future, though, and long-distance, low-skill jobs are the ones most subject to automation and a race to the lowest cost provider. Most retail workers at least had the gratification of leaving home, conversation with colleagues and customers, getting a store discount, and generally being a member of society. The reason that even well-meaning commentators suggest increasingly unlikely and tenuous ways for people to make a living is that they are trapped in the conventional thinking that people must trade their time, energy, and labor for money as the only way to survive. You stretch for answers because in reality there are none. The subsistence and scarcity model is grinding more and more people up. Preserving it is the thing we must give up first. Food preparation and service. For the number three job in America, the median hourly wage is $10 an hour with an annual average wage of $23,850. Most of these workers have not attended college. Food service and food prep workers are not in immediate danger of replacement to the same degree as our call center workers and retail workers. Mom-and-pop restaurants are not changing their practices anytime soon, and food service workers are generally so inexpensive that the incentives to replace them are modest. The restaurant industry is facing headwinds due to lower foot traffic in many places, more lunches eaten at desks, the lunch depression, high levels of competition, the decline of mid-price restaurants, and the rise of eat-at-home delivery services like Blue Apron. But people anticipate restaurants holding up better than traditional retail. Still, change is brewing. I had brunch with a venture capitalist friend in San Francisco. She told me an important story. A company came to me with a software product that helps fast food workers get scheduled for shifts more efficiently among multiple locations. Any given worker could be optimally assigned a shift across several nearby stores. It seemed like a good idea. But when I went to a couple fast food companies and I asked them if they would use this kind of software, their response was, "We're not trying to schedule our workers more efficiently. We're trying to replace them altogether." So I didn't invest in that company. Instead, I invested in a couple companies that make smoothies and pizza with robots and delivery. She's not alone. There is now a mechanized barista in a lobby in San Francisco. It's named Gordon. You can text in your order and the robot can be set up in most any location. I tried it and my Americano was delicious for about 40% less than at Starbucks. Gordon provides a more efficient, cheaper, and equally high or even higher quality product than a human barista. In the morning, when you are running late to work and all you want is a quick cup of coffee, these pluses will be valuable. After Gordon debuted, Starbucks was forced to issue a statement saying that it didn't plan on replacing its 150,000 baristas. Some workers will be easier to replace than others. For instance, we all like fast food drive-through restaurants for their efficiency and do not mind the limited human interaction. In fact, 50 to 70% of fast food sales take place at drive-through windows in the United States, McDonald's being the one that most of us know and used to love. There are 1 to 2 workers per location who take the order through the speaker. They wear those cool headsets. These workers will be replaced by software in many locations in the next 5 years. Publicly traded fast food chains will be among the most aggressive adopters of increased efficiencies because they have the scale, resources, and quarterly earnings pressures to maximize shareholder returns. McDonald's just announced an Experience of the Future initiative that will replace cashiers in 2,500 locations to start. The former CEO of McDonald's suggested that large-scale automation is around the corner. It's cheaper to buy a $35,000 robotic arm than it is to hire an employee who's inefficient, making $15 an hour bagging French fries, he said, while defending the current prevailing fast food wage of $8.90. The robot arm is only going to get cheaper and more efficient, while the fast food wage has no place to go but up. Approximately 4 million workers work in fast food. If you've been through an airport recently, you might have noticed restaurants that have replaced servers with iPads. Itza, a recently opened restaurant chain, has a whole row of iPads for you to enter the order, and then a series of lockers where your food appears. They've gotten rid of all of the front-of-house workers. Itza was recently named one of the most influential brands in the restaurant industry, and it's here to stay. All it takes is a few chains to bite the bullet and enjoy labor-free efficiencies, and the others will follow quickly. McKinsey estimates that 73% of food prep and service activities are automatable. On the production end, you can now use a 3D printer to make hot pizza in 5 minutes that can be customized to particular orders. BHEX's bot, called the Chef 3D, will appear at select theme parks and sports arenas starting later this year. Just like the robot barista, Chef 3D is faster, cleaner, and more reliable than human workers. Only one person is needed to work the machine, which can mix the composition and lay down the sauce and the toppings in 1 minute. Apparently, it tastes great. No more person in the back making pizzas by the oven. There are companies now launching that are essentially pizzerias on wheels, where they make the pizza in special trucks on their way to you in anticipation of your order. For the last mile, there are now food delivery robots being used in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco. They are essentially coolers on wheels that deliver food to your door for around a dollar. One company called Starship Technologies has 20 or so robots deployed that are already learning their local terrain in Washington, D.C., which has officially made self-driving robots legal on its sidewalks. These robots will eliminate the need for many delivery people. A friend of mine, Jeff Zarofsky, ran a chain of sandwich shops for a number of years. He said to me, "Our biggest operational issue is that sometimes people just don't show up to work. We pay significantly over the minimum wage, but employee reliability is a recurring problem." Food prep and service jobs are going to remain numerous for a while to come because of low costs and industry fragmentation. But fundamentally, most of the tasks are highly repetitive and automatable. Companies with resources are going to continue to experiment with new ways to reduce costs, and we will see fewer and fewer workers in many restaurants over time. Also, as regional economies weaken, restaurants in those regions will struggle and close. Clerical jobs, retail jobs, and food service jobs are the most common jobs in the country. Each category is in grave danger and set to shrink dramatically. Yet they're not even the ones to worry about most. The single most defining job in the automation story, the one that scares even the most hard-nosed observer, is the number 4 job category, materials transport, also known as truck driving. 5. Factory workers and truck drivers. You would have to have been asleep these past years not to have noticed that manufacturing jobs have been disappearing in large numbers. In 2000, there were still 17.5 million manufacturing workers in the United States. Then, the numbers fell off a cliff, as you can see in the accompanying PDF, plummeting to fewer than 12 million before rebounding slightly starting in 2011. More than 5 million manufacturing workers lost their jobs after 2000. More than 80% of the jobs lost, or 4 million jobs, were due to automation. Men make up 73% of manufacturing workers, so this hit working-class men particularly hard. About 1 in 6 working-age men in America is now out of the workforce, one of the highest rates among developed countries. What happened to these 5 million workers? A rosy economist might imagine that they found new manufacturing jobs, or were retrained and reskilled for different jobs, or maybe they moved to another state for greener pastures. In reality, many of them left the workforce. One Department of Labor survey in 2012 found that 41% of displaced manufacturing workers between 2009 and 2011 were either still unemployed or dropped out of the labor market within 3 years of losing their jobs. Another study out of Indiana University found that 44% of 200,000 displaced transportation equipment and primary metals manufacturing workers in Indiana between 2003 and 2014 had no payroll record at all by 2014, and only 3% graduated from a public college or university in Indiana during that time period. The study noted very few went back to school, and relatively few seem to avail themselves of a lot of the government programs available to assist displaced workers. The manufacturing jobs that still exist require more education and technical skills, as factories have become more advanced and automated. Jobs in manufacturing for people with graduate degrees grew by 32% after 2000, even as overall employment in the sector was plummeting. Of course, as we've seen, most people don't have graduate degrees or even college or associate's degrees, and it is unrealistic for many to get them. The recession led to this huge wiping out of one-industry towns, particularly in those places that were heavily dependent on the industrial or manufacturing economy, says Steve Glickman, CEO of the Economic Innovation Group. We're asking, what's around the corner for them? And we're seeing a shockingly low rate of new businesses that can become the new employers for those regions of the country. How do the 40% of displaced manufacturing workers who don't find new jobs survive? The short answer is that many become destitute and applied for disability benefits. Disability rolls shot up starting in 2000, rising by 3.5 million, with the numbers increasing dramatically in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and other manufacturing-heavy states. In Michigan, about half of the 310,000 residents who left the workforce between 2003 and 2013 went on disability. Many displaced manufacturing workers essentially entered a new underclass of government dependents who have been left behind, as you can see in the accompanying PDF. This is a good indicator of what will occur when truck drivers lose their jobs. The average age of truck drivers is 49, 94% are male, and they are typically high school graduates. Driving a truck is the most popular job in 29 states. There are 3.5 million truck drivers nationwide. Trucks that drive themselves are already rolling out around the world. Self-driving trucks successfully made deliveries in Nevada and Colorado in 2017. Rio Tinto has 73 autonomous mining trucks hauling iron ore 24 hours a day in Australia. Europe saw its first convoys of self-driving trucks cross the continent in 2016. In 2016, Uber bought the self-driving truck company Otto for $680 million and now employs 500 engineers to perfect the technology. Google spun off its self-driving car company Waymo, which is working on self-driving trucks with the big truck manufacturers Daimler and Volvo. Jim Scheinman, a venture capitalist at Maven Ventures, who has backed startups in both autonomous trucks and cars, says that self-driving trucks will arrive significantly before cars because highway driving is so much easier. Highways, the domain of semi-trucks, are much less complex than urban areas, with fewer intersections and clearer road markings. And the economic incentives around freight are much higher than with passenger cars. Morgan Stanley estimated the savings of automated freight delivery to be a staggering $168 billion per year in saved fuel, $35 billion, reduced labor costs, $70 billion, fewer accidents, $36 billion, and increased productivity and equipment utilization, $27 billion. That's an enormously high incentive to show drivers to the door. It would actually be enough to pay the drivers their $40,000 a year salary to stay home and still save tens of billions per year. Switching to automated drivers would not only save billions, but it also has the potential to save thousands of lives. Crashes involving large trucks killed 3,903 people in the United States in 2014, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and a further 110,000 people were injured. More than 90% of the accidents were caused, at least in part, by driver error. Driver fatigue is a factor in roughly 1 out of 7 fatal accidents. Most of us, when we were taught to drive growing up, were told to avoid trucks on the highway. There's a reason for that. So the incentives to adopt automated truck driving are massive. Tens of billions of dollars saved annually, plus thousands of lives. They are so large that one could argue it is important for national competitiveness and human welfare that this happen as quickly as possible. Adding to the incentives is that many freight companies report labor shortages because they can't find enough people willing to take on the physically demanding and punishing job of spending hundreds of hours sitting in a confined space. Truck drivers spend 240 nights per year away from home, staying in truck stops and motels, and 11 hours per day on the road. Obesity, diabetes, smoking, inactivity, and high blood pressure are common, with one study saying 88% of drivers had at least one risk factor for chronic disease. Many, however, will argue for the preservation of truck driving because they recognize just how problematic it would be for such a large number of uneducated male workers to be displaced quickly. Taking even a fraction of the 3.5 million truckers off the road will have ripple effects far and wide. It is impossible to overstate the importance of truck drivers to regional economies around the country. As many as 7.2 million workers serve the needs of truck drivers at truck stops, diners, motels, and other businesses around the country. Over 2,000 truck stops around the country serve as dedicated hotels, restaurants, grocery stores, and entertainment hubs for truckers every day. If one assumes that each trucker spends only $5,000 a year on consumption on the road, about $100 per week, that's a $17.5 billion economic hit in communities around the country. Beyond the hundreds of thousands of additional job losses, many communities may risk losing a sense of purpose without thousands of truckers coming through each day. For example, in Nebraska, one out of every 12 workers, 63,000 workers, works in and supports the trucking industry. Truck drivers do not see it coming. Indeed, when Bloomberg's Shift Commission in 2017 asked truck drivers about how concerned they were about their jobs being replaced by automation, they almost uniformly weren't concerned at all. Let me assure you, it's coming. Elon Musk recently announced that Tesla will be offering a freight truck as of November 2017. Musk also proclaimed that by 2019, all new Teslas will be self-driving. Your car will drop you off at work and then will pick other people up and make you money all day until it's time to pick you up again, Musk proclaimed. This will 100% happen. It is obvious that Tesla trucks will eventually have the same self-driving capabilities as their cars. Other autonomous vehicle companies report similar timelines, with 2020 being the first year of mass adoption. And it's not just those driving trucks who are at risk. A senior official at one of the major ride-sharing companies told me that their internal projections are that half of their rides will be given by autonomous vehicles by 2022. This has the potential to affect about 300,000 Uber and Lyft drivers in the United States. The replacement of drivers will be one of the most dramatic, visible battlegrounds between automation and the human worker. Companies can eliminate the jobs of call center workers, retail clerks, fast food workers, and the like with minimal violence and fuss. Truck drivers will be different. Right now, the federal government has said that it will allow autonomous vehicles in any states that permit them. One industry report noted that the U.S. Department of Transportation is throwing its full support behind development of autonomous vehicles as a way to improve safety on our roadways. In 2016, the trucking industry spent $9.1 million on lobbying, and the Ohio government has already committed $15 million to set up a 35-mile stretch of highway outside Columbus for testing self-driving trucks. Arizona, California, and Nevada have begun allowing self-driving car trials in their states, and others will follow. Will truckers and the industry fight back? Back in the 1950s, truckers were highly unionized, with the Teamsters being legendary in their aggressiveness. Today, only about 13% of U.S. truckers are unionized, and 90% of the trucking industry is made up of small businesses with 10 or fewer trucks. About 10% of truck drivers, 350,000, are solo owner-operators who own their own trucks. The trucking companies have been pushing drivers to buy or lease their own trucks to reduce overhead. It will happen in stages. First, there will be automated trucks with a human driver as a failsafe. The technology will allow truckers to go beyond their current 11 hours per day on the road, as the driver will be able to rest and do other things during long stretches. This will increase the productivity of trucks and equipment and likely reduce the wages of truckers as the pay scale changes. The next stage will have convoys of trucks, with the lead truck having a driver and the others following automatically, which lowers wind resistance and fuel costs. There will be docking stations outside urban areas where drivers will enter the trucks for the last 10 miles. At some point, as the industry becomes more and more automated, truck drivers will realize that the combination of much more efficient trips and lower need for labor will dramatically shrink their total employment. Those who have other options will flee the field. But for many, their opportunities outside of truck driving will be minimal, and they know it. Many are ex-military. About 5% of Gulf War veterans, 80,000, worked in transportation in 2012. They will be proud and desperate. What might happen when the 350,000 American truckers who bought or leased their own trucks are unemployed and angry? All it takes is one out of 350,000 to lead the others. It doesn't take a big leap of the imagination to imagine mass protests that could block highways, seize up the economy, and wreak havoc. The best estimates for when this will unfold are between 2020 and 2030. That is right around the corner. 6. White-collar jobs will disappear too. Here's an article written in 2017 about an earnings report for a jam company, J.M. Smucker. EPS estimates down for J.M. Smucker in past month. Over the past 3 months, the consensus estimate has sagged from $1.25. For the fiscal year, analysts are expecting earnings of $5.75 per share. A year after being $1.37 billion, analysts expect revenue to fall 1% year-over-year to $1.35 billion for the quarter. For the year, revenue is expected to come in at $5.93 billion. A year-over-year drop in revenue in the fourth quarter broke a three-quarter streak of revenue increases. The company has been profitable for the last 8 quarters, and for the last 4, profit has risen year-over-year by an average of 16%. The biggest boost for the company came in the third quarter, when profit jumped by 32%. Notice anything off about the piece? The prose isn't going to win any awards, but it's perfectly understandable. As it turns out, the article was written by AI. A company called Narrative Science produces thousands of earnings previews and stock updates for Forbes and recaps of sports stories for fantasy sports sites in real time. The company's bots won't be winning any Pulitzers in investigative reporting, but in the coming years, the quality of AI-produced writing will go from acceptable to very good. And those journalists who write routine stories like this will find their jobs increasingly at risk. We tend to think of automation as displacing blue-collar workers with jobs that involve basic repetitive skills. The truth is a little bit more complicated than that. The important categories are not white-collar versus blue-collar, or even cognitive skills versus manual skills. The real distinction is routine versus non-routine. Routine jobs of all stripes are those most under threat from AI and automation, and in time, more categories of jobs will be affected. Doctors, lawyers, accountants, wealth advisors, traders, journalists, and even artists and psychologists who perform routine activities will be threatened by automation technologies. Some of the jobs requiring the most education are actually among the most likely to become obsolete. Some of these threatened workers, like investment advisors, may find themselves surprised to be on the chopping block after supporting the profit-growing potential of automated technologies. A friend of mine is a radiologist at Columbia University. He told me a story about how the chair of his department was recently invited to General Electric to take part in a demonstration where humans would compete with computers to read patient films. GE invited doctors with decades of experience, the tops in their field, to see whether the doctors could more effectively diagnose tumors based on radiology films than a computer. Guess who won? The computer won quite easily. It turns out a software program can see a shade of gray on a film that is invisible to the human eye. The computer can also draw on millions of films to compare it with, a much larger reference set than even the most experienced doctor. We are entering an age of superintelligent computers that can take any complex data set, every legal precedent, radiology film, asset price, financial transaction, actuarial table, Facebook like, customer review, resume bullet, facial expression, and so on, synthesize it, and then perform tasks and make decisions in ways that are as good as or better than the smartest human in the vast majority of cases. To think that this will not dramatically change the way organizations perform work and the employment of people is to ignore the way companies operate. Companies are paid to perform certain tasks, not employ lots of people. Increasingly, employing lots of people will mean that you're behind the times. During my brief tenure as a corporate attorney when I started my career back in 1999, I practiced at Davis Polk & Wardwell, one of the top firms in the world. When we were assigned a deal, the first thing we would do was look for whatever deal precedent we had in the system that was most similar. We used to joke about how much of what we did was finding and replacing terms in a contract. There is a lot of repetitive functioning in what we consider high-end professional jobs, what I call intellectual manual labor. A doctor, lawyer, accountant, dentist, or pharmacist will go through years of training and then do the same thing over and over again in slightly different variations. Much of the training is to socialize us into people who can sit still for long periods and behave and operate consistently and reliably. We wear uniforms, either white coats or business suits. We are highly rewarded by the market, paid a lot, and treated with respect and deference for accruing our expertise and practice. Basically, we are trained and prepped to become more like machines, but will never be as good as the real thing. As you can see in the accompanying PDF, the Federal Reserve categorizes about 62 million jobs as routine, or approximately 44% of total jobs. The Fed calls the disappearance of these middle-skill jobs job polarization, meaning we will be left with low-end service jobs and high-end cognitive jobs and very little in between. This trend goes hand in hand with the disappearance of the American middle class and the startlingly high income inequality in the United States. The vanishing jobs are due in part to the incredible development of both computing power and artificial intelligence. You might have heard of Moore's Law, which states that computing power grows exponentially, doubling every 18 months. It's hard to understand what exponential growth means over time. Take the example of a 1971 Volkswagen Beetle's efficiency. If it had advanced according to Moore's Law, the vehicle, in 2015, would be able to go 300,000 miles per hour and get 2 million miles per gallon of gas. That's what's happening with computers. People didn't think Moore's Law could hold for the past 50 years, but it has, and computers continue to get smarter. Intel, Microsoft, Google, and IBM are investing in quantum computers, computers that store information on subatomic particles that would extend Moore's Law for years to come. We are just now hitting the rapid ascent of computers that are unfathomably fast and powerful. When the IBM computer Deep Blue defeated the world's foremost chess master in 1996, people were impressed, but not that impressed. Chess is a game where there is a very large but finite number of moves and possibilities, and if you have enough computing power, you can project out all of the next possible steps. Go is another story. Go is a 3,000-year-old Chinese game with theoretically infinite moves. In order to beat the world's best Go players, an AI would need to use something resembling judgment and creativity in addition to pure computation. In 2015, Google's DeepMind beat the world's best Go player and then did it again in 2017 against other world champions. Go champions looked at the DeepMind strategies and said that it used moves and tactics no one had ever seen before. New kinds of AI are emerging that can do much of what we now consider intelligent and creative. You might have heard the term machine learning, which is an application of AI in which you give machines access to data and let them learn for themselves what the best methods are. Machine learning is particularly powerful because you don't have to prescribe the exact actions and routes. You set guidelines and then the AI starts synthesizing data and making choices and recommendations. Some of the early applications of machine learning include tagging images, spam filtering, finding keywords in documents, detecting outliers for credit card fraud, recommending stock trades, and other rules-based tasks. Machine learning is often used in conjunction with another term you've heard, big data. Because of the digital revolution, we now have access to much more information than at any point in history, and the rate of new information is growing exponentially. One estimate is that more data has been created in the past 2 years than in the entire history of the human race. For example, we perform 40,000 search queries every second just on Google, which adds up to 1.2 trillion searches per year, each of which represents a new piece of information. By 2020, about 1.7 megabytes of information will be created every second for every human being on the planet. Much of this information is mundane, a catalog of people clicking on friends' photos on Instagram and the like. But the point is that in this flood of new data, there will be very useful pieces of actionable information. The author Yuval Harari postulates a world where, based on analyzing your online data, an AI could tell you which person you should choose to marry. There is now big money pouring into trying to process all of this information. One estimate is that a typical Fortune 1000 company can make another $65 million a year by increasing its use of data by 10%, and that only 0.5% of available data is presently analyzed and used. Another estimate is that the healthcare system could save $300 billion per year, or $1,000 per citizen per year, with improved use of data. Industries that utilize large amounts of data, like financial services, are already being transformed to take advantage of new capabilities. The finance industry is in many ways a natural home for automation. The tasks are highly repetitive and logical, the institutions are rich and efficiency-minded, and the culture is hyper-competitive. Founded in 2008, Betterment is an automated investment service that by 2017 had more than $9 billion under management. With lower fees and automated investment decisions, Betterment and its competitor Wealthfront largely replace the traditional financial advisor. Said the Financial Times, younger clients don't want and can't afford an annual meeting with an advisor talking about the relative pros and cons of emerging markets, bonds, or structured products. They want simple guidance and 24-hour access. They don't want advice delivered in an office. They want an app. By 2020, global assets under management of robo-advisors are projected to skyrocket to $8.1 trillion, and 72% of investors under 40 said they would be comfortable working with a virtual advisor. 5,500 floor traders once roamed the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Now there are fewer than 400, as most trading jobs have been taken over by servers running trading algorithms. Those scenes you see on CNBC are not of the New York Stock Exchange, but of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where they still have enough humans to make a good backdrop. Goldman Sachs went from 600 NYSE traders in 2000 to just 2 in 2017, supported by 200 computer engineers. In 2016, the president of the financial services firm State Street predicted that 20% of his 32,000 employees would be automated out of jobs in the next 4 years. A new AI for investors platform called Kensho has been adopted by the major investment banks that does the work that used to be done by investment banking analysts to write detailed reports based on global events and company data. Kensho is valued at $500 million after less than 4 years in business. With Kensho, a report that would have taken 40 hours for a highly educated human being paid $250,000 per year can now be done in minutes. Accordingly, Bloomberg reported that Wall Street reached peak human in 2016 and will now shed jobs progressively, which has been borne out by layoffs this year at most of the major banks. The insurance industry, which employs 2.5 million Americans, revolves around processing information, which also makes it particularly ripe for automation. McKinsey predicts a massive diminution in insurance staffing across the board, particularly in their operations and sales agent departments, projecting a 25% total decrease in employment by 2025. That will mean hundreds of thousands fewer white-collar workers in cities around the country. Accountants and bookkeepers are vulnerable too. One accountant described switching from billing per hour to monthly retainers because cloud accounting software was automatically doing the bookkeeping and he suddenly wasn't spending any time on it. There are 1.7 million bookkeeping, accounting, and auditing clerks in the United States, and an additional 1.2 million accountants and auditors. Bookkeepers and clerks are already starting to disappear. Accountants talk bravely about shifting their time to advise clients on financial strategy. I've employed half a dozen accountants in my life, and most of the time you just want to get your taxes done and filed. Even occupations that revolve more around words than numbers are at risk. A Deloitte report in 2016 projected that 39% of jobs in the legal sector will be automated and that the industry should expect profound reforms in the next 10 years. In particular, paralegals and legal secretaries are expected to be replaced, and overall employment in the sector is expected to shrink as many law firms will contract or consolidate. When I went to law school in the late 1990s, people regarded it as a safe career move. Today, law schools churn out many more graduates than the market requires, and the market for their services is shrinking. A friend of mine runs an AI company that is automating basic litigation tasks, routine responses, filings, and document review for large companies who won't need to hire as many freshly minted lawyers as a result. I met with Cliff Dutton, the chief innovation officer of a global legal processing company, who described how human attorneys have about a 60% precision rate reviewing boxes of legal documents. I remember performing document review as a young associate. My eyes glazed over after a couple of hours, even when I was trying hard to focus. The comparable rate for AI-enabled software is already closer to 85% accuracy, and it's a lot faster than a team of lawyers could ever be. Even more than lawyers, doctors have built up their expertise, wisdom, and decision-making ability through many painstaking years of both training and practice. Yet I asked a high-end doctor friend who attended MIT and Harvard how much of medical practice he thought could be performed via automation. He said, at least 80% of it is cookbook. You just do what you know you're supposed to do. There's not much imagination or creativity to most of medicine. I sat with a technologist to project which aspects of medicine were most ripe for automation. His responses were radiology, as discussed earlier, pathology, very similar, family medicine, a nurse practitioner or even layperson could handle most issues with the assistance of AI, dermatology, similar, and a couple other specialties. He also talked about how surgeons he knows enjoy the robot-assisted operating theater because it greatly enhanced their vision and ability to see things, and the robot tools automatically accounted for unwanted movements and motions like a trembling hand. Also, students who are meant to train could see everything without being in the room, and the surgeon could review his procedure after the fact. I asked if doctors could potentially perform surgeries from remote locations. He responded, eventually. Right now, doctors want to be nearby, and the latency of long-distance data transmission still could cause delays or lags. Still, he agreed that robo-assisted surgery will soon open up the ability for a top surgeon to perform surgeries around the world. It also means that you can record surgeries and all of the micro-decisions that surgeons make. With that data, eventually, AI could analyze thousands of surgeries and know what to do in every situation. The first robot dental implantation, with no human intervention, just took place in China in September 2017. The robot went in and installed two new implants that had been printed by a 3D printer. Robot supersurgeons might be one generation away. Most people assume that humans will always have the advantage over AI when it comes to work that requires creativity, like painting or music, and jobs that require nuanced, sensitive human interaction, like therapy. In fact, Google's neural network, a computer system modeled to think like a human, has produced art that could easily be confused for human beings, like the work in the accompanying PDF. You can also check out a symphony online that was composed by a software program, Iamus, which many listeners found indiscernible from a human composition when it was performed. Google Add Some by Iamus and take a listen. You might have figured that therapy would be the last province of automation. If so, you were wrong. USC researchers funded by the Department of Defense in 2016 created an AI therapist named Ellie to treat veterans for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Ellie appears as a video avatar and provides soothing questions and responses. Ellie measures voice tone and facial expressions to try to identify whether a soldier needs to seek additional treatment with a human counselor. Early research is promising and indicates that soldiers often feel more comfortable confiding in a clearly artificial therapist than an actual human being. Ellie is meant to be a complement to human therapists, but one can easily imagine her checking in with patients in between appointments and taking on more over time. When I was 13, I had to have four teeth pulled in preparation for wearing braces. I was actually kind of excited about it because I saw my dad's teeth and was like, whatever it takes, let's not have those. I remember going to the dentist and wondering what kind of magic he would employ to pull the teeth. Not much. Dr. Goodman just put some pliers on the first tooth and yanked and jerked until it came out. The second one was stubborn, and he had to shift positions a few times. I remember him putting his foot on my chest and yanking away. I walked away thinking, wow, dentists have to be kind of strong to do what they do. Also, my jaw hurt. I tell the story because often the boundary between what we consider intellectual and manual work will be unclear. Surgeons are among the highest trained, most highly compensated doctors because cutting people open is a big deal. Yet their highest value work is, for the most part, manual and mechanical. My surgeon friends often swear off activities like basketball because they're worried they'll hurt their fingers or hands. Some jobs might not go away the instant new technology arrives that could replace them. Much of how automation unfolds in medicine is dependent upon regulations and licensing. It is presently illegal to do many things without a doctor or a pharmacist license. This is very likely to be a field where technical innovation far outstrips implementation because doctors will fight the steps and they have a very powerful lobby. They will argue that no one is as good for a patient as a highly trained human doctor, even in the face of dramatic evidence to the contrary as AI improves. Some patients also might prefer seeing a human doctor, though I suspect this preference will fade over time. There are many obstacles to AI truly becoming broadly intelligent. One neuroscientist described most systems today as being better than a human could ever be at one specific task and dumber than a 2-year-old at anything else. Still, our conception of what is beyond the capacity of a computer is about to change. There's a lot of white-collar and creative work that can be automated. In startups, we have a saying of what to do when you're not sure what the answer is. Throw money at the problem. Soon the answer to everything will be throw AI at the problem. If you think your job is safe from computers, you'll probably be wrong eventually. The purpose and nature of work is going to change a lot in the next 10 years. The question is, what will drive this change, aside from the fact that fewer of us will have jobs to go to? 7. On humanity and work. I've been in one significant car accident. I was 20 years old, driving at night from Providence to visit my brother in Boston. I was behind the wheel of my family's old Honda Accord. It was a rainy night. As I approached Boston, full-speed highway traffic ended with a traffic light, and I noticed only when the stopped car in front of me was way too close. I jammed the brakes and my tires screeched, but I still hit the car in front of me hard. The impact crumpled the rear third of the car in front of me and caved in the front of my old Accord, which folded up like an accordion. I jerked forward into my seatbelt, stunned. After a few seconds, I got out and went to the car in front of me. Is everyone okay? The sight of the ruined car in front of me made me cringe. No one was hurt. There were 3 people in the car not much older than me. They were shaken up but fine. They weren't angry at all. I apologized several times. I felt like a grade-A jerk. We all waited for a police car and tow trucks as cars went past us in the rain. We made small talk about how we weren't sure if our cars were salvageable. It took about 30 minutes, but it felt like hours. I rode in the passenger seat of the tow truck to the garage and waited there for my brother to come and get me. The garage was closed, so after the truck driver left, I waited outside in the rain on the curb with my head in my hands. I remember this night in part because I had broken up with my college girlfriend, or she had broken up with me, earlier that day. This was back when people dated in college. I was upset about it and was heading to Boston to hole up with my brother. It's safe to say that my emotional state contributed to my inattentiveness and may even have been a key factor in my rear-ending that car. Our humanity is what makes us unique. People are the most important aspect of all of our lives. That said, our human qualities may not always make us ideal drivers, counselors, servers, salespeople, help desk workers, and so on. Drivers lose concentration. Counselors break confidences. Servers have bad days and are rude. Salespeople have biases and act inappropriately. Help desk workers get bored. And so on. There's a big distinction between humans as humans and humans as workers. The former are indispensable. The latter may not be. Yuval Harari in Homo Deus makes the point that our cab driver can look into the sky, contemplate the meaning of life, tear up at the sounds of an opera, and generally do a million things that a robot driver cannot. But most of those things don't matter to us when we get into the back of the cab. Oftentimes, we prefer to be left alone rather than make conversation. I know I'm occasionally guilty of this. One of the common themes of the new economy is that women are better equipped to excel in the growth areas and opportunities in a service economy, including nurturing and teaching other people, which are among the toughest activities to automate. Conventionally male-dominated jobs like manufacturing, warehouse shelving, and truck driving are among the easiest. I've heard women say, "Why don't men just adapt and take on more feminine roles?" That's a lot easier said than done, and I'm not convinced asking people to go against type because the market demands it is the right response. The market doesn't care what's best for us. Trying to reshape humanity to meet its demands may not be the answer. On other fronts, there are significant initiatives to include more women in high-paying fields like technology and finance that remain predominantly male. I've started a few companies and enjoy nothing more than building great teams of people who are happy engaged with their work. That said, I think that many people both overestimate the qualities that humans bring to work and underestimate the drawbacks of hiring humans. Here's a partial list of things that can make people imperfect workers in management an all-consuming role. People generally require a degree of training. We typically want more over time. We need to rest. We require healthcare that you sometimes must pay for, and we can be very particular about. We get sick. We want to feel good about what we're doing. We have bad days. We can't do the same task precisely the same way millions of times. We have families who we want to spend time with. We are sometimes bad at our jobs and need to be fired, in which case we generally want severance pay or we will make you feel bad. We get bored. We have legal protections. We occasionally sue our employers. We can become demoralized and unproductive. We take 15 to 20 years of rearing to become productive, and then we are unproductive and infirm for 10 to 15 years of the back ends of our lives. We often want you to pay us to account for both the time at the end and the cost of raising our children. If something bad happens to one of us, the others notice. We occasionally harass each other or sleep with each other. We sleep. We sometimes are dishonest and even steal. We occasionally quit and look for other jobs. We see things. We share information. Some of us use drugs. We get injured and disabled. We are unreliable. We sometimes change our minds. We sometimes take breaks when we should be working. We sometimes organize and negotiate for various benefits beyond what we could get on our own. We sometimes have bad judgment and can act in ways that will tarnish your brand. We have social media accounts. We expect time off for holidays. We sometimes get divorced or have relationships end, which can make us sad and unproductive. We sometimes talk to reporters. You cannot sell us to another firm. We do not come with warranties. Our software often does not upgrade easily. At the beginning of the book, I quote Terry Goh, the founder of the Taiwanese manufacturing company Foxconn, comparing humans to animals. He brought 300,000 robots into his factories to supplement his million workers making Apple products, in part because 14 Foxconn workers had committed suicide in the previous 2 years. In contrast, robots do not experience emotions and do not get depressed. The automation wave is coming in part because, if your sole goal is to get work done, people are much trickier to deal with than machines. Acknowledging this is not a bad thing. It is a necessary step toward finding solutions. It may push us to think more deeply about what makes humanity valuable. It's worth considering whether humans are not actually best suited for many forms of work. Consider also the reverse. Are most forms of work ideal for humans? That is, if we're not good for work, is work good for us? Voltaire wrote that work keeps at bay three great evils: boredom, vice, and need. The total absence of work is demonstrably a bad thing for most people. Long-term unemployment is presently one of the most destructive things that can happen to a person. Happiness levels tank and never recover. One 2010 study by a group of German researchers suggests that it's worse over time for life satisfaction than the death of a spouse or permanent injury. There is a loss of status, a general malaise and demoralization, which appears somatically or psychologically, with prolonged unemployment, said Ralph Catalano, a public health professor at UC Berkeley. On the other hand, most people don't actually like their jobs. According to Gallup, only 13% of workers worldwide report being engaged with their jobs. The numbers are a little better in America, with 32% saying they were engaged with their work in 2015. Still, that means that more than two-thirds of Americans aren't exactly skipping on their way to and from the office each day. As comedian Drew Carey put it, "Oh, you hate your job? Why didn't you say so? There's a support group for that. It's called Everybody, and they meet at the bar. Most of us struggle to find work that we're excited about, particularly if we have financial goals and pressures to meet. Even the successful among us have made a number of compromises and learned to more effectively adapt to them over time. When you encounter someone who really likes his or her job, you remember it because it's so rare. The relationship between humanity and work involves money, but in something of a negative correlation.